was obvious, it was at least understandable that we would focus attention on these midpoint glands that either feed or are repositories of lymph tissue. We carried out a thymectomy. I think it helped in graft survival, but I know it did, but in the long run, some of the incidence of malignancy in those patients, especially with lymphomas, was higher than with the thymus in, and we gave that up. We carried out splenectomy for a number of years, and with conventional immunosuppression, there seems to be little doubt that splenectomy as a means of weakening the immune system is useful. There have been good randomized trials. There were two at the American Surgical a couple years ago. It's not necessary anymore. It's sort of a footnote. Next slide. This man tried lymphoid depletion, always going after those killer cells, but by a different technique, using thoracic duct drainage, in which billions of cells can be taken out of the thoracic duct. This man works at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. He was acting on information provided by Jim Gowans, whose picture I showed earlier, in which it looked as if full immunodepression with thoracic duct drainage, and it was true, in rats required only 5 days. He assumed it would be the same in humans, but it wasn't learned until 20 years later by McLeader and Paulus at UCLA and by us that in order to make thoracic duct drainage work, it requires at least 21 and optimally 30 days of pretreatment, not 5 days. So his technique would have been widely used, except it was not used properly. And by the time we finally really knew how to use thoracic duct drainage, there was no further need for it anymore. Next slide, please. I think there is a future need for thoracic duct drainage because it also depletes the antibodies by a mechanism that nobody understands, and thus is going to enable us to get at the one final problem of transplantation, of renal transplantation, that hasn't yet been solved. This is another technique of lymphoid depletion, very straightforward in concept. Was first used by some Swiss workers. Woodruff worked in it on it in the 50s. It is the raising of antibodies against human lymphocytes. One gets lymphoid tissue from lymph nodes or the spleen or the thymus, injects with particular techniques. Rabbits, I think, is the best. Goats or horses. You bleed them. What we did was did exhaustive tests and found out exactly where the antibody was, exactly where it was, and we purified it on columns, extracted it, and made it ready for intramuscular injection. This was added to the therapy with Imuran and prednisone, and has become known as the triple drug form of therapy. 2-3 years later, they adopted it in Minnesota. They've done a wonderful job with it there, and they've used it at Stanford for most of their heart transplants until recently. Next slide. Well, this is our report on this. This was an all-star cast. Again, Tom Marguerre was around, Porter, Iwasaki, who was chairman of the surgical department in Japan, and Jim Cirelli, who was just got up as chairman at Albany. This outlined everything. How to immunize, how to take it out, how to give it, and its first clinical trials. Next slide. Now, in the meanwhile, another interesting phenomenon had surfaced, which Tom Rosenthal mentioned on Saturday, but I'm going to go into it for a minute because there's a lot that still needs to be done. This is a kidney which had been transplanted 30 minutes before and was blown right out of the body. And the way that happened was that it was placed across a blood group barrier, that it was placed into an environment in which there were preformed antibodies that These represented the first examples of hyperacute rejection that had been seen. It was, as it turned out in retrospect, the explanation of why Voronoi's patient, the Russian patient in 1936, had lost the kidney. It was transplanted from a B donor to an O recipient, and an O recipient has anti-B isoglucans, which killed the kidney. This kidney was killed. Next slide. This is what the inside of it looked like. It was just utterly destroyed. Its vasculature was ruined. And so, as a result of that, we evolved, next slide, please, the bees. Permissible rules of tissue transfer. This is from the book in 1964, but the whole story had already been played out by 1963, O to O, and so forth. It's pretty self-evident. That could be avoidable, be avoided. But also in 1963, Tarasaki, Tom Martiero, Paul Tarasaki of California. Tom Martiero and I saw another patient who I think was almost identical to a heart recipient that hyperacutely rejected a heart recently. Next slide. And I'll put this in case any cardiac surgeons were here. This is what it looks like. We gave this information at a meeting one of the federal agencies in 1963. It was the first case of hyperacute rejection of cytotoxic antibodies. For some reason, we didn't see any more for a while, and then in 1966, Chris Meyer Nielsen of Denmark described two more cases, and then a tremendous avalanche of hyperacute rejections. We still see them. And when you have patients with antibodies that end up deposited like this on grafts, they sometimes are completely non-transplantable. Next slide. Here is Paul Tarasaki. This is Paul Tater, who was the first of the organ transplant organ coordinators. Tarasaki here, a couple of his young associates. They're still hard at work, busier than ever. Next slide. Also, there were problems. These gentlemen, Tarasaki et al., were of course interested, besides the antibody question, in tissue typing. And so we entered in 1965 with them the first prospective attempt to use tissue typing, which I'll describe for you in a minute. At the same time, there were some interesting developments in preservation. We used to with our living-related transplants in the early 60s, we used to use total body hypothermia. I guess the reason we did was that Henry Swan had spent so much time at Colorado that the techniques were safe. And so we did it. I think it's dangerous. And later on, we just began to cool with this kind of material. Tarasaki and Collins, a surgeon now at San Diego, changed the electrolyte composition, became even better. You can preserve kidneys in so-called slush like this for up to 2 days. Next slide. And then this was another technique which we used in the early 60s. When brain death wasn't accepted, we would do these little cutdowns on femoral artery and vein and then perfuse, put the patient right back on cardiopulmonary bypass after death. Next slide. These are all of only historical interest. These two young men, again in their college days, this is Fred Belzer, now chairman of surgery at the University of Wisconsin, working together with, next slide please, this young man, who is now dead, Sam Coons, developed a technique of preservation of asanguineous organ perfusion. The one thing, though, that since this is supposed to be historical, that I don't think has ever really been acknowledged, is the fact that two other people had already assessed and approved the concept that this was possible, and they were John Ackerman who now works in Florida, at that time was in South Africa, and Chris Barnard. They had done the whole thing with diluted blood, and so it's too bad that Barnard, and maybe it was a little flamboyant for our taste, but he did do some interesting things, and that was one of them. This boy came from a poor family. Next slide, please. Well, almost from the beginning, it was obvious that transplantation was going to be great, was going to do a lot of things not previously possible. Here was our first series at 5 years. Far more than 50% of those kidneys were going. These were related cases. And then it got better as time went by, as these ALG and other things came in. I actually left the field in 1972 for about 6 years. Next slide, please. Thinking that it would be all taken care of. But this is the grim part of the story. These are the non-related or essentially cadaver cases in which the 1 year survival of patients and grafts in those early 60s was only a third. And then most of the gains in the survival of those grafts in subsequent series were due to the fact that dialysis had become available and was financed from federal sources. Next slide, please. Oh, this is just a summary. Next slide, please, of some of the things that we've talked about. These are the agents, the drug, immunosuppressive drug regimens used clinically, and I'm bringing it on now because it introduces the final step. There's Imuran, the whole Boston story before 1962 I've already told you about. They started with Imuran in 62, Imuran and steroid combination. I think all of these places, usually it's hard to say exactly how the exchange was so thorough and unselfish between the various groups that it's really hard to say who did what. Boston was against steroids. I never knew what Hume was up to, except that it was always right. And Woodruff, they were all about the same. We had a meeting in September 1963 in Washington, and the numbers of good cases that were coming from these centers, there were just three in the United States at that time, functional. Those were Denver, Boston, and Richmond, made it clear that the field was going to really fly. Thoracic duct drainage, mentioned ALG as an adjunct, and it's still very suboptimal. Here, these are just little footnotes, they hardly are worth anything. Cyclosporin was introduced in clinically in 1978 by Kahn of Cambridge. He's recommended and still recommends that it be used alone, and I think that's suboptimal. We put it immediately together with steroids when we got it. We had much trouble getting it in this country. We got it about a year later and put together what I think is the definitive version, which by now is, I think, is being used everywhere, at least in the States. Cyclosporin became available in two places in the States in late 79 at Harvard and at the Grady. In fact, the same great place and in Denver, but they were very much under the influence at that time of the English group. And also, they were extremely fearful of the threat of lymphomas, and so they used it very much the way the Cambridge and later Oxford groups did, and they did not get good results. But here and at the University of Minnesota, about 9 months later, and at Houston, all of the groups had good results. And here, I won't go into that because Tom Rosenfeld gave a magnificent summary of the Pittsburgh experience last Saturday. Next slide. Well, other groups not deeply involved in development of immunosuppression, adapted these techniques to their own specialties. Some of you will recognize Norm Shumway here. This is Lauer, who now works out in Virginia. Their development was almost exclusively in the field of technique. And their eventual clinical trials depended heavily on immunosuppressive regimens that had been developed in simpler models. That whole story of cardiac transplantation is an interesting one. I believe I remember that Mark Ravitch was at a Society of University Surgeons meeting a few years ago in which Jim Hardy gave a presentation of the first heart transplant that had ever been done down in Jackson, Mississippi, in which a chimpanzee had been used as a donor. And the discussion of that paper was brutally critical. The discussion was by Shumway. And this picture of such a punctilious conservative was presented by him that it made it difficult to go forward with cardiac transplantation. And so Shumway jumped the gun, and that was that. It created a lot of hard feelings, I know, and then Barnard didn't behave in a perfectly proper way. But Barnard made an important contribution, and his results in those early days were good. He ended up with a 60% one-year survival. So this group was the second to do hearts. Next slide. But the real issue and defect with immunosuppression was always this kind of information. Tom Rosenthal gave slightly different figures, but about the same on Saturday. The countrywide average of successful cadaveric kidney transplantation, 50% at 1 year. And this CIOP district that we work in here has an average of 45%, same as this. That's the countrywide survival. So, the end of the story, which up to this point has been human striving and a lot of suffering, next slide, came here from this man, Morrell, a marvelous scientist working for the Sandoz Corporation, developed a drug which did not cause bone marrow toxicity and was more effective at preventing rejection and interdicting manifestations of other immune iatrogenic immune diseases like allergic encephalomyelitis, allergic arthritis, than any other drug ever described. Next slide, please. The drug was tried first. It was released in England to this group at Cambridge. They did a good job with it. And at the Royal Marsden Hospital, where a man named Powys had it for bone marrow transplantation unit, there was a problem with that they ran a very high mortality here. I think it was almost 40% in these cases. And there were three lymphomas out of 34 cases. We were certain we knew what the problem was. The article was published on the eve of our trial in Denver, and I spent many hours talking to them in England. Finally decided to go forward with it there, believing that we knew where the what the problem was with all these lymphomas. Couldn't have come at a worse time. We began those trials in November, and within 1 month, or about 6 weeks, there was circulated around the state to all the nephrologists a document soliciting evidence of unethical behavior for using this drug. But then the red faces got redder as the year went by, and even in our learning phase, there was no problem like this. And the cadaver survival, even though we were using a drug combination for the first time for primary grafts was 80%. And as you heard on Grand Rounds on Saturday, it looks as if we're better than 90% at the University of Pittsburgh. That may well be the last slide. Well, this is the way that prednisone and cyclosporin work together. Remember those long graded taper off of steroids that were necessary in the old days with Boomerang. Within 5 days, we try to have the patients down to about 20 milligrams of prednisone. And then subsequently, it's usually possible or even necessary because of side effects to reduce the cyclosporin as well. I think that made the last slide. Now, this is just a liver patient, very much the same quick withdrawal of steroids and then a reduction of cyclosporin. It's made a tremendous difference for liver transplantation, in which the survival is doubled. It's made a major difference in renal transplantation, in which the survival of primary grafts has almost been doubled. And from what Tom Rosenfeld showed us on Saturday, it's obvious that the survival of retransplants is almost tripled with this drug. Next slide, please. I'm just panicking now, trying to figure out how to finish. Well, that's an incomplete and I'm sure unfair accounting of history. I've been around it for 25 years.
This has been a recording by Dr. Thomas E. Starzl on March 23, 1982, given at a meeting of the Carol F. Reynolds Historical Society on the subject of historical aspects of the development of transplantation.